It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We look to Capitol Hill now and check in with Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin on congressional budget battles and how to avoid a looming federal government shutdown next month. And later, we'll discuss potential aid to Israel in a war against militant Palestinian group Hamas. You can be part of the discussion along the way. Call in with a question. Share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. The federal government, though, operating under a temporary spending package set to expire in less than a month. Is that enough time to pass a new budget?
Well, it's not passing a budget. It'd be passing appropriation bills. It's just pretty much the well-honed process that's been developed here, where you don't pass appropriation bills during the fiscal year prior to the fiscal year that you're trying to fund, and instead you force Congress to start passing continuing resolutions, have those continuing resolutions end prior to like a Thanksgiving break or a Christmas break, then drop a multi-thousand page bill on members' desks the day before the CR expires, expect enough people to vote for it, pass the omnibus bill, and forget about it. That's the process that has landed us more than $33.5 trillion in debt. It's mortgaging and plundering our children's future. So it's a well-honed process. It's incredibly dysfunctional.
So the current...
We need to break that cycle.
So the current continuing resolution expires on November 17th, at which point Congress would need to, as you mentioned, agree on the 12 appropriations bills, send another continuing resolution to the president, or risk a shutdown. What will it be?
It'll probably be a continuing resolution.
Would you support that?
What I'm proposing right now is probably have a continuing resolution that goes through about the end of March to the end of April. I've actually laid out a calendar how we could bring up six different combinations of appropriation bills, keep defense separate because I think that's the top priority government, and then do what they call mini-buses, but have them just be a couple bills so that some of these appropriation bills get the scrutiny they deserve, and then begin the fiscal 2025 appropriation process as soon as that's done. So we're actually bringing up appropriation bills in the fiscal year prior to what you're trying to fund. But again, this is Washington, D.C. is an alternate universe. I come from the private sector. It is bizarre how broken and dysfunctional this place is, but people unfortunately have grown accustomed to it, and enough people don't have big enough problem with it where it hasn't been fixed. So I'm proposing to repeal the Budget Act of 1974, which has never worked. We ought to move to a two-year budget cycle, so you have to pass six appropriation bills a year while you're providing oversight to the other six, and then the following year you reverse that. That would give us enough time to bring these appropriation bills. We probably need to change rules in certainly the Senate chambers to facilitate the debate on these bills and the passage of these bills. Congress needs a complete overhaul when it comes to how it appropriates money and how it passes legislation.
So you also have the Prevent Government Shutdown Act of 2023, which is being proposed by your colleague, Oklahoma Senator Jim Lankford, which would make automatic continuing resolutions should the budgets lapse. How do you feel about that bill?
Well, this is a piece of legislation that when I was chairman of Homeland Security, I told my committee I was going to pass some form of Preventing Government Shutdown Act, and we had a number of proposals. I selected James Lankford and Maggie Hassan. She's a Democrat senator from New Hampshire, and there was a bipartisan bill. They do exactly what Wisconsin does. We don't, if there's dysfunction, we haven't appropriated for an agency or for all of government in Wisconsin, we don't shut government down. We just continue operating government at last year's levels. I mean, incredibly common sense. Now, we passed that through my committee. Every Democrat senator voted for it back in 2019. We've been trying to get a vote that would give it a chance of passage on the Senate floor. Haven't been able to do that yet. It's one of the reasons I objected to the minibus is to be able to get a vote on that particular measure. It looks like if we go to this one minibus we're talking about, we would get a vote on that. But again, these shutdowns are ridiculous. We do shut down every now and again for a few days. Only about 10% of the government actually shuts down. It's just one of these make-believe crises that leadership relies on to continue this very well-honed process of mortgaging our kids' future. It ought to end.
We're talking with Wisconsin's Republican Senator Ron Johnson, looking at national politics and the state of Congress and the budget. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Senator, the Republican-controlled House has yet to elect a new speaker. Congress, of course, cannot pass spending packages without House leadership. Is gridlock in the House affecting your ability to do your job in the Senate?
Well, obviously, we're going to need the House to be able to pass appropriation bills as well. I was hoping that Jim Jordan would already be elected Speaker. I hope he is eventually. I mean, Jim is a person of intelligence, very high integrity. He's a person who actually is concerned about the fact that we're mortgaging our kids' future, that we're $33.5 trillion in debt. And I heard earlier in the break, Congressman Pocan talking about Jim Jordan being from the extreme wing. Well, the reason he says he's from the extreme wing is Jim Jordan actually cares about the fact that we're $33.5 trillion in debt. I don't view that as extreme. I view that as fiscally conservative, and we need more people, certainly in leadership roles, that are concerned about our out of control spending. This can't go on. We're going to spend close to $2 trillion more this year than we spent just 4 years ago.
Well, presuming Jim Jordan will eventually get enough votes for the gavel, how would Jordan work with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to find unified Republican positions on major issues?
I think he'd work well.
You do.
I've known Jim since 2011. Jim and I worked on something called Cut, Cap, and Balance back in 2011, which resulted in the Budget Control Act, which actually real cuts to discretionary spending for 3 years before Congress weaseled out of those spending caps. So Jim's a very practical individual. He's a true fiscal conservative, but we need a true fiscal conservative in leadership positions. We cannot continue to plunder our children's future the way we're doing it.
Let's take a call. Jeff in Delafield is here. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I think the issue is that the average American citizen, I don't think, really understands the impact of this debt on their daily lives. The 7.5%, whatever percent it is for a home loan, that's a direct result of bond investors not trusting the fiscal creditworthiness of the federal government. They're bidding up the interest rates. That translates down to home loan rates, and it's affecting each and every one of us. And I can't believe that the average citizen understands that, or they wouldn't put up with these deficits the way they are. And I just think that needs to be boiled down to very simple terms, and people need to understand that is directly impacting their ability to buy homes and buy cars. And
Jeff, thank you.
Else.
I want to get Senator Johnson to respond here. Go ahead.
Well, I completely agree with Jeff. I think part of the problem is our education system really doesn't teach economics the way we should. Certainly our news media doesn't point out the fact that it's this massive deficit spending causing the inflation, causing high interest rates. I mean, a dollar that we all held at the start of the Biden administration is now only worth 85 cents. But that's why food prices are so much higher. You know, the war on fossil fuels driving up energy prices, gasoline prices, that also sparks inflation. So, the pain you're feeling in terms of not being able to afford what you used to be able to afford, that's all caused by out-of-control deficit spending and high debt run by the government.
Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin with us, getting reaction to a Congress facing daunting challenges, including the risk of a federal government shutdown about a month away. You can be part of the conversation, calling in with a question, sharing your views, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have three-term U.S. Senator Ron Johnson on the line on what to do about the potential for a federal government shutdown in mid-November, as we've been talking about. And we now look to the senator's views on emergency aid to Israel in its latest war with the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts at any point. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Turning to Israel now, President Joe Biden yesterday visited demonstrating American support for Israel. What are your thoughts on how Biden is responding to the war between Israel and Hamas?
Well, I appreciate the fact that the president is expressing to Israel the U.S. support for its ability to defend itself. It's important to understand who the terrorists are, who the aggressors are, you know, who the aggrieved party is. And let's face it, if a similar type of a terrorist attack were occurred in the U.S., where the same percentage of our population were murdered horrifically, we'd be talking something like about 50,000 Americans being slaughtered in a day or two. That's what 1,400 Israelis equates to, 50,000. You can imagine what reaction America would have. Now, I'm encouraged by the fact that the Biden administration is expressing support. And also, I think giving advice, and I think the Israelis are well aware of this as well. They saw the reaction of the public to the false reports of the hospital bombing. I mean, it's pretty obvious that that was a wayward missile coming from Hamas that killed those people in the hospital. But they saw the public reaction to that false report. I think Israel will hopefully find achievable objectives and try and go about destroying Hamas as surgically as possible, and Israel do everything it can to avoid civilian casualties. I mean, that is the difference between Hamas and terrorists and a civilized nation like Israel that is just, you know, exercising its right to defend itself and prevent another horrific terrorist attack as occurred a couple weekends ago.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier this week introduced the resolution to support Israel, and you and 98 senators are co-sponsors on that. What aid would you support the American government providing Israel?
Well, first of all, it's important to realize that we provide, you know, billions of dollars of military aid to Israel every year, and right now there's not a, from what we're being told, there's not a huge emergency requirement right now. I mean, they obviously need additional missiles for their Iron Dome and some other munitions, but there's not a need for a huge amount of money. So I want to actually sit and listen to what is going to be required. I think they will get that. From my standpoint, these aid packages ought to be separated. We ought to take a look at each situation differently as opposed to combine them in some massive package. You know, ill-defined, you just pull $100 billion out of the air and say, oh, we got to do this because there's an emergency. That's exactly the method that's being used to, again, plunder our children's future. So
would you
be far more thoughtful about this, but again, 100% support Israel.
Would you send weapons to Israel?
We do send weapons to Israel.
Would
we do it on an ongoing basis. Yeah, we need to help Israel defend itself.
Would
that's
you?
That's why we have two aircraft carriers based now in the Mediterranean as a deterrent so that Hezbollah doesn't open up another front in the war. But no, we're going to support Israel, and I appreciate the fact that the Biden administration is expressing that and demonstrating that support.
Would you support an Israel funding package that includes aid for Ukraine to defend itself against Russia?
Well, that's hypothetical. I'm hoping that they don't combine these aid packages. We got to look at each situation individually. There's no need to combine these.
President Biden also announced yesterday that the U.S. is providing $100 million in humanitarian assistance for the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank. Do you support aid to Palestinians, and at what level?
I certainly understand that there are Palestinians trapped in Gaza that don't support Hamas. And we want to avoid humanitarian disaster as relates to those individuals. Unfortunately, Hamas is not allowing civilians to go to the south, although quite a few have already gone there. You know, I'm certainly for, and I think Israel's for, humanitarian support for those individuals as well. So again, the dollar amounts, I mean, it's a matter of getting the water flowing. It's a matter of getting the support in there where it can be inspected so that it's not, you know, these truckloads and cargo loads of container loads of humanitarian aid don't contain weapons as well. So you've got to be careful about this. But again, understand who the aggressor was and the right of Israel to defend itself and hopefully be able to, over time, destroy Hamas so they can't do this again.
Are you concerned about our military in the state of the House's chaos and dysfunction without having a speaker, without being able to pass any type of packages and move things forward here?
Yeah, my main concern about the military is the type of military leaders that the people like the Biden administration are promoting that are more concerned about wokeness than they are military readiness. And that's my main concern. I think the military will be funded. Again, I do not like continuing resolutions. They're not good for the military. We need a far more organized approach, which is what I'm trying to impose. I mean, I wrote an op-ed that the Wall Street Journal ran the day after I got reelected that laid out exactly how we should organize our efforts so we could get past the debt ceiling, we could pass a budget, we could pass appropriation bills during, you know, again, last fiscal year, prior to this fiscal year. I laid it all out. You know, unfortunately, Senate leadership, House leadership didn't follow my game plan there, so here we are. But I'll keep pushing for an organized approach to funding government so that our military and the finest among us can be paid.
We're talking about national politics and the international world. Wisconsin's Republican Senator Ron Johnson on the line. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Perry in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Yes, I have a question. We have a war over in Ukraine with Russia invading Ukraine. Ukraine is working to keep all of the world safe, but also most of our friends in Europe, and it seems like the Republican Party is really downplaying their support that they had over a year ago. And I wondered how much of the friendship with Vladimir Putin that Mr. Johnson has comes to play with that.
Senator Johnson, go ahead.
Well, first of all, Perry, you realize that I'm banned from Russia. Putin does not view me as any kind of friend or ally whatsoever. I've been to Ukraine numerous times. I'm the only member of Congress at President Zelensky's inauguration. At that point in time, and the meeting I had with him following that inauguration, he wanted peace with Russia. The very sad fact of the matter is there's no doubt about it, Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. Nobody wants to support his efforts. We condemn his efforts. We want to support the brave citizens of Ukraine who are defending their families. But unfortunately, this now is the stalemate. And in the end, it's going to be a negotiated settlement. We're not going to like the settlement. But every day that this war goes on, this settlement is going to get worse and worse because more Ukrainians, more Russian conscripts, more Ukrainian civilians are going to die. More of Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And we've got to figure out some way to bring this war to an end. So we again, Americans support Ukrainians, but we need to bring this war to an end.
In our last minute together, I want to turn to the Farm Bill. In late September, the 2018 Farm Bill expired. This is a multi-year trillion-dollar spending package covering most American agriculture programs, and the next bill has yet, as you know, to reach Biden's desk. What would you like to see added to the Farm Bill?
Well, again, this is just another example of the dysfunction in Congress. It is unfortunate for example, the farm bills combined with the food stamp bill, the vast majority of the funding here is in food stamps, and we've pretty well made eligibility or expanded eligibility for food stamps, which has expanded that program as a percent of to the American population. And when you combine all the elements of a farm bill, you've got to accommodate sugar farmers in Florida and wheat farmers in Kansas and, you know, dairy producers in Wisconsin, and it becomes a big muddled mess. So what I do is we listen to farmers in Wisconsin and we fight for their interests, and I'll continue to do that. Hopefully we can get a farm bill across the finish line here sooner rather than later, but it's what I'm trying to do is bring function back to Congress, and right now it's grotesquely dysfunctional.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Have a great day. Stay well.
You too. Ron Johnson is a Republican U.S. Senator representing Wisconsin, has held this office since 2011. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can go back and stream it later today at WPR.org/mornings. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We highlight the Milwaukee restaurant Birch that is included in the New York Times' annual restaurant list, the only one to make it from Wisconsin. But first, participation in high school football in Wisconsin declined more sharply than in any other state over a 10-year period. And this year, some high school football teams have had to forfeit games, and other schools are finding they no longer have enough players to finish out their season. Corrine Hess reports on how schools are adapting to fewer kids playing football.
It's homecoming at Bigfoot High School in Walworth County, and the stands are packed with parents and students gathered to watch their team crush Monroe.
And now the starting lineup for your Bigfoot Williams Bay Sheepdogs.
Before the game, student Valak Channing says he's feeling confident about his school.
Well, we're going to catch a dub here. We're going to mercy roll these kids.
But this homecoming game is different. This year, the Friday night lights are shining down on the boys' varsity soccer team. Bigfoot's homecoming football game and the two games leading up to it were canceled. Bigfoot only has six seniors on its football team, and key players got hurt. District Administrator Doug Parker says, ideally, each class would have about 15 football players. But over the last several seasons, fewer kids are playing.
If we had JV kids that were eligible to play, we would. But we're not going to put a 5'1", 110-pound freshman on a varsity football field just to play a varsity game.
Bigfoot is not alone. Wisconsin saw a nearly 25% decrease in 11-player football from 2009 to 2019, according to the latest data available from the National Federation of State High School Associations. That's the largest decline in high school football participation in the country. The reason for the decrease in participation is hard to pinpoint. Experts say one factor could be anxiety about concussions. In some cases, boys may be choosing to play a different fall sport, such as soccer or volleyball. And some decline in participation may be because high schoolers prefer screens to sports. In Wisconsin, boys' soccer participation is up about 4% over the last decade, while boys' volleyball is up about 20%. But those fall sports still draw far fewer players than football. Most states have seen fall participation decline. A few, including Texas, have seen slight increases. Krista Niehoff heads the federation that tracked this data. She believes when new participation numbers are released, football will still be at the top of its game nationally.
Overall, interest in the sport of football is healthy. We're not sure about what's happening in Wisconsin.
Todd Clark with the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association says the biggest drop in football participation was between 2012 and 2016. That coincides with more media coverage of contact sports causing concussions. Since then, Clark says the number of football participants has flatlined. Clark says schools with strong football programs have tended to see less drop-off in participation.
It hasn't been a secret. Successful programs draw kids in because people like to win.
At Bigfoot, the soccer team was more than happy to take the homecoming spotlight for the evening. Looking out at the stands before the game, soccer star Hudson Torres says he had never seen so many fans.
I mean, football has always been a big sport. I mean, we won state in like 2009 for football. So, I mean, it's good to see a different change with soccer now. We're ranked ninth in the state, so I think people are starting to really like come and enjoy the games.
For the most part, parents and students didn't mind the change either. Nicole Raskin, who is a student council advisor and the parent of a senior, says making the switch to soccer was the best solution the school could come up with.
As a parent, we have heard only positive. Every single comment said, we hope our football players get healthy, and we're very excited to see the soccer team get this experience.
And even without the football game, Bigfoot High School was able to keep their homecoming traditions alive. They crowned the homecoming queen and king at halftime, and as predicted, the team won their game. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The New York Times names the Milwaukee restaurant Birch to its annual list of best restaurants in America. The contemporary farm-to-table restaurant was the only one in Wisconsin named to this list. We have executive chef and co-owner Kyle Nall, who was nominated by the James Beard Foundation for Outstanding Chef in the United States last year. You can join this conversation. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kyle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What are you thinking about making this list?
Super exciting. The first thing that I thought about was our awesome staff and how excited I am for them and for all the guests that eat at Birch often. And for the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin, just super excited that we got this recognition.
Well, walk us around the restaurant. Birch specializing in cooking with an open fire. What does that look like, and why specialize in an open hearth?
You walk in a restaurant and kind of the first thing you see and smell is this beautiful hearth where the fire is burning. And it's really the only option we have to cook in our restaurant. And it lends us to really cook simplicity and to let the ingredients shine that we buy from local farmers. And it really helps define, our food in general.
Do you have limitations because you need to only cook with a live fire, an open fire?
Sure. I mean, our kind of number one goal is to buy the best produce from the community around us. And so when we buy these amazing vegetables, it lets us keep it simple. We let the vegetables shine. We cook them simply over the fire. We really don't have anything to hide behind except for the amazing, the amazing produce.
Birch's menu is seasonal, regularly changes. What challenges does this present in Wisconsin's, colder winter months when you are trying to source locally?
It's funny. So we opened in the summertime of 2021, and once we got through fall that year, our guests that would come in often, that was a question they asked, like, what are you going to do through the winter? And we luckily have some really great relationships with farmers that sell a good amount of produce through the winter months. And so now I think this will be our third winter to kind of go through. And the last two, we did a really good job of using these root vegetables and being creative, with these items. Our menu does change daily. We print it every day, and I'd say something changes on the menu every day. And our goal is to, if guests come in, if a guest came in to eat at Birch last night, many of them would come back next week. And our goal is to let them have a different experience when they come back. And, they might have a same dish, a similar dish, but we want to give them something exciting. The way we look at it is if it's, a Wednesday night, it could be just a normal Wednesday night dinner. But if we have like asparagus for the first time of the year, that changes kind of a quiet, normal dinner to something exciting.
Asparagus takes the stage, might even take the lead a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we want. We want, you know, we get excited about that. And we want the guests to, we want our guests to experience that excitement as well. And, you know, sometimes it kind of goes through to the guest, and sometimes it's just a delicious bite of food for them. But, you know, our goal is to change the menu regularly, which is difficult in the winter, but I think we do a really great job with it. And, but we do stay true to our ideas and our values of buying produce through the winter with, from our local farmers that we know.
You mentioned root vegetables. What are vegetables you enjoy cooking with this time of year?
I mean, kind of that idea of when things happen for the first time in the season. So, like, mm-hmm. right now, we just started to get some squashes. One's called Autumn Frost, and then one's called a Honey Nut Squash. And in my opinion, you know, they have the familiar squash flavor that people are used to, but they're a little sweeter and they have a little more going on than like the average like butternut squash. So like the honey nut squash was actually cultivated to, it looks like a butternut, but it's a quarter of the size. And how I explain it to guests is that this vegetable was grown to have more flavor. So if you think about how big a butternut squash is, if you shrink it down, you're really just kind of taking out the water and the things that don't have flavor. So those two things right now are super exciting. But, you know, we're starting to have cauliflower and Brussels sprouts. And the cool thing is we still have things like ground cherries, a few tomatoes, a little corn. So this time of year is like truly the split of the seasons and super exciting.
It sounds like a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah.
How do you choose what recipes to cook at Birch? I mean, what are those conversations like in the kitchen?
You know, we kind of talk when we have new team members start in the kitchen. You know, when you start there, you are given recipes when dishes change for like dressings and sauces and things like that. But we've really talked about it's more of like a mindset and a philosophy more than just recipes. Like recipes are guidelines that truly change a good bit. Obviously there are some things that are like, you know, weighed out perfectly and will never change, like our focaccia, our pasta dough, like our ricotta cheese that we make. But everything else is like really based on taste. And, you know, once you kind of work in our kitchen a good bit, you kind of, you grow that trust with this. And it's really about the idea of what we're doing and not really a recipe, which makes us, you know, makes it so that we have to stay on top of.
We just had a little bit of a pause there. I'm going to reintroduce you. Kyle Nall, executive chef and owner of the Milwaukee restaurant Birch, the restaurant named to the New York Times' list of best dining spots in America. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have executive chef Kyle Nall, co-owner of the Milwaukee restaurant Birch. It drew attention from the New York Times' journalists and dining critics. They fanned out across America searching for their 50 favorite restaurants, and Birch is the only one in Wisconsin made the Times' restaurant list. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kyle, you worked in restaurants all over the United States, ranging from your hometown of Birmingham, Alabama, to New Orleans, to New York City. Why move to Milwaukee?
So my wife is from here, and we wanted to be in a community where we could raise a family. And, you know, that's really kind of it. We've always loved Milwaukee, and we looked at it as an opportunity to put down some roots and, yeah, raise a family and be a part of a great community.
And compared to other places, is Wisconsin a welcoming business climate to open and operate a restaurant?
It's truly been incredible. I mean, since we opened 2.5 years ago. It's, you know, our the people that eat at the restaurant often, the people that come in for the first time, just the community in general have been so welcoming, and it's just been truly incredible.
Okay, and this is a personal question. As you co-own Birch with your wife, Megan, how do you maintain a work-life balance with both of you involved in the business?
You know, we just had our second child 4 months ago.
Congratulations.
And so that obviously plays a deeper role and a different layer in our relationship. And, you know, I think we work really well together, and she plays a large role at home with the kids when I'm at the restaurant and vice versa. But it's truly just a great team effort between both of us.
How does a restaurant owner, you know, stay competitive in a really competitive industry, and at the same time not get burned out? I mean, you're changing a menu every day.
You know, it's all, we just have so much fun, and it's all about, it's what we love. So, it makes being at the restaurant, you know, so much and working so much, just fun. Like, of course it gets, to be a lot some days, but you know, I'd say 98% of the time it's we're doing what we love. And, I feel like we're just so lucky to be able to do that and to have people that receive that and, really appreciate it.
Looking more closely at labor, we occasionally talk with restaurant owners about challenges finding and retaining employees. How do you ensure that Birch can financially support its staff?
I mean, honestly, I think getting press that we just got and getting national press, getting local press, finding ways to stay, you know, relative to the community and making sure people see us and hear about us as much as possible, I think is the biggest challenge. You know, we tell each other after we got this recognition from the New York Times that this is not a guarantee of business. It's an opportunity. So our business has really jumped since this article came out. And, you know, it's a great honor. It's a lot of work has paid off for it, but it actually, you know, it actually created more work in terms of like, now we have to really work hard and show people who are coming in for the first time, why we got this recognition and hopefully prove to them that we're somewhere to come back to. But I do think it's so important for us to stay relative and keep our name out there. And, that's definitely the biggest challenge is to make sure people are thinking of us when they're thinking about going out to dinner on a Tuesday night or a special occasion.
Workers in the restaurant industry, hospitality industry, they've struggled with stagnant wages and earning a living wage. What could fix this?
When we opened Birch, I had, and I still have high hopes for, creative ideas, and I don't know what they are. It's hard to like think about and be creative about ways to evolve and taking care of your employees when you're in like the kind of the everyday grind. Me personally, it all starts with just taking care of everybody who walks through our door and works for us. You know, if we had someone that was in an accident and was out for about a month and a half, and you know, I made sure that we paid them through their time off, and it's just important to take care of the people who are already there. But I do think there has to be something that changes in the future, and it can't be just one restaurant. It can't be like four restaurants in Milwaukee are now all like hospitality included, and you know, where prices for tips are built into the menu cost. I think that's like a way that will change, but it can't be just like four restaurants doing it, because and then you kind of stand out and people will choose to go somewhere else. It has to be like a community-wide change. And I don't know what that is. I hope that, we can figure that out in the future, because I think our industry and our employees and our staff deserve to be taken care of. And it's really difficult.
We have the Milwaukee Restaurant Birch, Kyle Nall, the restaurant's co-owner and executive chef. You can join in the conversation. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. Add comments along the way. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kyle, you're also the culinary director at Stonebank Farm near Oconomowoc, and Stonebank Farm played a role in getting you settled in Milwaukee in 2020. How did the farm help you get acquainted with the local food scene?
Sure. So my wife, my mother and father-in-law live in Brookfield, which is like a 15-minute drive from Stonebank Farm. And literally our first day after moving to Wisconsin, they took us out there. And we had a tour of the farm, walked around, and I fell in love completely immediately. And I knew that it was going to play a role in what I do somehow. So I actually started working there, in the heart of like 2020 and 21 when things were still shut down and restaurants weren't really in existence still. And, I got to see what there was to offer through the seasons, vegetable wise, get to really connect through the community. And then once I had the opportunity to open Birch, I stayed on board and kept that tie to the farm. And for instance, we just raised 26 lambs at the farm that will be served at Birch over the next like 5 months. Mm. So it's done a really good job of anchoring me to the agriculture and making sure that, I go out there one day a week. When I go out there, it kind of ties me back.
It grounds you. Yes.
Yeah.
We only have a few seconds left, but you told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel you plan to open a new pizza place in West Allis. What's up with that? Yeah.
So we're hoping it would open the springtime next year. It's going to be in a development right next to the West Dallas Farmers Market. And that's actually where we buy like 98% of our produce is from that market. So we had the opportunity to be literally next door to it. And I couldn't say no and wanted to jump on the opportunity to be even closer to that market and to those farmers that we love to support.
I can just see wheelbarrows of fresh produce going into the restaurant and topping the pizza. Oh, Kyle, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Kyle Nall is executive chef, co-owner of the Milwaukee restaurant Birch. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.